From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, final exams, the true crime cases from Cyril Wett. Cyril, of course, is the noted pathologist. He won't be on, but the author, Donna Kaufman, will be our special guest for the program. Here's what's happening. Ferguson, Missouri. Well, first and foremost, I went out there. This is a story, of course, that has been on for at least a week all around the country. Ferguson, Missouri, the case where a police officer shot to death a young African-American man, and all heck has broken loose ever since. Let me tell you a little bit about my experience out there today. Ferguson, Missouri, not too far from where I am in St. Louis, about 25 minutes. So I went out there. And it was pretty calm. Matter of fact, it's been calm for the last two nights. We had a severe thunderstorm go through the St. Louis area tonight, so that quelled a lot of things. But it's been peaceful. And as a matter of fact, I saw some people out there barbecuing with police officers there sharing some of the barbecue. So that's how that seems to be going. First of all, on television, it makes it look like the entire St. Louis area is ablaze or is being looted, and there are civil disturbances all over the place. Not the case. This is in a very small area of Ferguson, Missouri, which is, one, a small city, but, two, this is really contained to around six blocks, maybe a little bit more. Now, during the initial civil disturbance, the looting, setting fires, a convenience store was truly destroyed. I saw that. It has been obliterated. It may have been a police substation as well. That could be another reason why the demonstrators took that place out. So that's that situation. People were just milling around. There were some police cars in the area. A lot of businesses are open, but they have boarded up their windows for safety purposes, but they've got signs out there that says open for business. I feel sorry for the shop owners of these small little ma-and-pa type businesses because they're going to get wiped out if this thing continues. So we'll see what happens there. In the meantime, apparently a grand jury is starting to look at the case and investigate the police officer. But again, we don't know publicly a lot of what has been going on. I mean, there's been stories that the police officer's eye socket has been fractured in the altercation with the young man. There's all kinds of stories that are out there. And I trust the investigation will proceed and get the facts that we need in order to move this area and this country forward again, because it's totally ludicrous. And I will say this again, the police officers, by and large, and the folks in that area are trying to work together. They really are. They're not as uptight as they were a week ago. There are some rabble-rousers who are coming in from outside of the St. Louis area, outside of Missouri, and they're creating the problems, the big problems. And so, again, I hope the investigation proceeds. And we'll find out exactly where it's going to go, and we'll be reporting on it. Oh, yeah, one last thing. I went by the area where the media has been kind of pushed to the side, even though they're allowed to go all over the place. There were more satellite trucks. These are trucks that are there for the cable companies and the local TV stations. There were more satellite trucks out there than protesters that I saw today. Unbelievable. I mean, they're all over the place. And that's a potential problem, too. I really wonder if the media just picked up right now. I mean, the story's been going on long enough. Picked up right now and went home, if the protesters would go home, too. Something to think about. The theft of personal data belonging to about 4.5 million healthcare patients earlier this year was made possible because of the Heartbleed bug, according to a leading security expert. Community Health Systems, the U.S. second largest profit-making hospital chain, announced that its systems had been breached. And the organization overseeing the safety of U.S. nuclear reactors has fallen victim to overseas hackers three times in the past 3 years. Citing an internal investigation, The NextGov website reports that computers at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission were successfully hacked on three occasions. Two of the attacks were conducted by foreigners, and the third came from an unidentifiable individual. Experts say that foreign powers could use the NRC's sensitive information for surveillance or even sabotage, although the commission says that the handful of attacks were detected and dealt with immediately. Lauren Weinstein, expert on the Internet Force. Lauren, I think this is more serious than they're talking about.
Well, you know, the thing here is that, as you said, we're talking about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is just a building full of paper, basically, in Washington, D.C. We're not talking about the actual reactors, so we're not talking about hackers who were, grabbing fuel rods and throwing them around the containment buildings or anything like that. I actually am kind of surprised to hear that it was only three. in reality, basically, the government, the Defense Department, is under continuous, quote, attack, unquote. A lot of these are automated. There's scanners. There's things that everybody else is being attacked with, too. This is something that doesn't get talked about a lot, but the government just gets kind of attacked like everyone else is attacked. If you run a small ISP or you run your own network or anything that's exposed publicly, you're frequently seeing, thousands and thousands of attacks. But so, when they say three, I guess this was the three that attracted their attention, or maybe they came out in a Freedom of Information Act request or something. I'm not really perturbed by this, because it just, the kind of information they have at the NRC is sensitive. It's interesting. It's statistical. There's some operational data. I worry a lot more, and we've talked about this in the past, about the actual functioning systems at reactors, at power plants, and things like that, that are often connected to the Internet when they shouldn't be, really. And when they're connected, it's often with old hardware that still has default passwords and hasn't kept up to date. There's a lot more damage that can be done that way. I don't think anyone can bring the whole grid down or anything, nothing like that, but certainly it's just stupid. It's dumb to have those systems exposed. So what really went on here with the NRC, I suspect there were a lot more than three, but I'd rather have them, at the NRC than at the big operational nuke plant.
That's right. Lauren, thanks. Lauren's website, of course, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. In 2010, an Icelandic volcano spewed an ash cloud into the skies that disrupted travel for millions of passengers and cost airlines a small fortune. Now another volcano is rumbling in that region, prompting fears of a repeat of the travel chaos that afflicted northern Europe. Its name is Bardabunga. That's the name of the volcano. And while there's no sign yet of magma flow moving to the surface, according to Iceland's meteorological office, something's definitely up beneath the Earth's surface. So watch out there. Another patient is being tested in the United States for possible Ebola exposure, this time in California. The unidentified patient is being isolated in a specially equipped negative pressure room at the Kaiser Permanente South Sacramento Medical Center. Trained staff are using protective equipment coordinated with infectious disease specialists to provide care for him or her. The patient is considered low risk, and tests are being conducted out of an abundance of caution, they say. Still no word, though, on the two other Americans that were taken to the CDC facilities in the Atlanta area. I hope they're doing okay, but who knows? Contacting spirits through the use of radio frequency devices, or so-called boxes, as a medium for direct communication has been a huge topic of discussion. I wrote about it in our book with Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Talking to the Dead. The main device, of course, was made by Frank Sumption. It's called Frank's Box, or the Ghost Box. This device was created by Frank several years ago as a means to further his interest in EVP research. Frank has recently passed on, but in a moment, we're going to be talking about his work, his legacy. Bill Murphy back with me on Coast to Coast AM, and he's next. Don't go away. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Bill Murphy back with us as well. He had collaborated with Frank Sumption since 2006 and received box number 21, and that was back in March of 2007, which was used to hear a warning of global consequences witnessed by 75 people during a public demonstration. The aftermath of this warning, which accumulated in the military operation codename Operation Orchard, convinced Bill that Frank's box works in ways that still, at that time, cannot be explained. And as I mentioned, Frank Sumption has passed away. Bill, we've lost a great champion for the paranormal, haven't we?
I agree with you. We certainly have, George.
It's good to have you back with us, too, Bill. When he gave you box number 21, how many did he end up making?
The number that can be best be totaled is 180, but some of the boxes that he built, he never did release, so they're not among the 180 that he released into the community.
When he started building these, Bill, what did he come up with? What did he do in terms of his research to even start building a box that could try to hear or communicate with the other side?
Well, he was experimenting with a couple of things. One of them was EVP Maker software by Stefan Bion. And EVP Maker software, you would just, you know, record like a WAV file. You could set how far away you wanted to slice that audio recording, and then you would randomly reassemble it and play it back. And he was intrigued by that, but he was also very much intrigued with electronics and being able to do this real time. And the second inspiration was an article that came out in October of 1995 in Popular Electronics, and it was titled Ghost Voices.
There's an incredible story about you and Frank on the program with me back about 5 years ago that had to do with a prediction of an East Coast tidal wave. Tell us about that, Bill.
Well, I have to tell you, George, from the very beginning, that when I contacted your producers and I suggested that, you know, perhaps Frank and the predictions, and I know it was sort of a dark title with doomsday predictions from the box, but that nevertheless that's what he was getting. But when I approached you guys and you gave us an air date, that slot happened to be the day before this supposed disaster would occur. And so I was kind of concerned that we were setting ourselves up for embarrassment. Because it was like, instead of being one of those people that say, I predicted this, and it's after the fact where you make the proclamation, in this case, it was ahead of time. And as you pointed out during the broadcast, you said, wait, August 15th, this is the 14th. It's actually it's the 15th for some of our listeners now.
Uh-huh.
It's completely clear skies on the East Coast of the United States. And you questioned me on the year that people were getting from listening to the box, and there was no year. And you said, ah, okay, that's a little bit of an out there that there is no year. So, nevertheless, we continued with the show, and it was an interesting interview. And after we were done, I watched the weather the next day, and I saw that there it was on August 15th, but it was off the west coast of Africa, a tropical depression formed. And it formed a strong eye. It was very defined, and it moved up the Atlantic to the east coast of the United States. And whether you want to call it a coincidence or a prediction, true to what Frank and others that were getting these messages had claimed, it formed a hurricane, which became Hurricane Bill is what it was named, and it swept several people out to sea, a young girl and another unidentified person, and they were both drowned off the coast of Maine.
Oh,
so it almost fulfilled a doomsday prophecy that Frank was speaking of. Again, perhaps you could say it's a coincidence, but Frank was convinced this is one of a long number of predictions that he was getting.
This box, Bill, when you turn it on, what do you hear? Do you hear static first, or what's it like?
It depends on which generation of the box, because some of the early ones would require a period of warming up, and you would hear static, you would hear it trying to tune, you would hear the voltage regulators, its capacitors charging up and discharging, and so you were getting noise that I would not describe as static. static, more like it was straining to tune, yet before it could, the frequencies would change on it. And then after a short amount of time, just a few minutes, it would begin to sweep pretty vigorously, and you could adjust that sweep rate depending on which version of the box that you had. And once you would get, obviously, it'd be voice fragments because you're listening to the radio. And you could have AM or FM. You could choose which band on many of the boxes. And what the concept was is that these random audio fragments played together would deliver coherent messages.
Was box 100 better than box number 21?
I wouldn't say it was necessarily better. The clarity certainly became improved. There were even versions that were later versions that did not perform as well as the earlier analog-equipped tuners would. It would really depend on a number of factors, and Frank freely collaborated with a number of people in the community. He never really took full credit at all, because what he was doing was, originally in the 1970s, people were doing swept-tuned radio sessions, mm-hmm. that in hopes that they were getting something similar. Frank just automated that process, and the other people in the community contributed circuitry ideas, and it gradually it did improve. But it almost doesn't matter which generation or version of the box you have. Some of them just perform better than others.
What was Frank's thoughts, Bill, about the other side and what might be on the other side? Because did he ever get demonic voices as well as lost souls, for example?
Frank never claimed to ever have definitive proof of what it was that he was seeking answers to. So he left it open-ended. It doesn't mean that he wasn't hearing repeated phrases that he took to be addressing him. And, you know, it took on the moniker of Purple Princess, for example, which, you know, he was humorous about that. He says, you know, why I'm being called this. I believe they're calling me out, and this isn't my identity, but nevertheless, I keep hearing this over and over. And so some of these phrases that seem to repeat themselves, he put some stock in, and other ones he didn't. And a lot of people who've obtained Frank's boxes, they report that they're hearing his name being spoken. It's calling Frank over and over. And I've actually experienced that as well. The boxes seem to be calling him. I think everyone who uses them has to be cognizant of what's referred to as top-down loading. When you have an expectation you'll hear something out of the randomness, you will form patterns that make sense to you. And so that's always a danger, and Frank was aware of that.
Well, he'll be missed. And is there anybody to follow in his footsteps, Bill?
There are a number of people that have continued to build boxes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, Steve Halte is a person that contributed a lot to Frank. He still credits Steve Halte for suggesting improvements. For an example would be, you know, Frank equipped some of his boxes, not all of them, a very small minority, with what he called an echo chamber. And it was just a series of tubes that had a small mic on one end and a small speaker on the other. So the output of the box would go into this chamber, it would echo, and then the microphone would pick it up and send it back into the box, and then you'd hear it out of the main speaker. And then Steve had suggested to Frank an electronic echo chamber, similar to what you would have with a guitar effect, for example. And Frank said, wow, that actually works so well if you want to include echo, which he thought would help, then do it electronically. And so that's just one example of other people contributing.
That's exciting, though. I just love it. And when technology continues to get better, you know, better circuitry and everything else, will that help equipment like this, the boxes?
Well, you know, you first have to look at the premise behind it. I mean, you know, Frank never claimed that this was the end all. This was just one way to automate what people had been doing. I already mentioned the manual tuning sweep that people would do just by spinning a dial. I've already mentioned the software version. And Frank goes, well, why not take all of this and just make it's a device. And in a way, you would play it play the box, not necessarily just turn it on and sit back. I've seen some people, and I had a tendency to do it myself, you almost play it similar to an instrument, for lack of a better comparison, often continually adjusting the sweep rate, adjusting the volume, perhaps even changing AM to FM bands. And it wasn't a passive process, and it still isn't for a lot of people. When Frank would do it, he would always continue to fiddle with it, and I think perhaps I was emulating what I saw him do.
Bill, we're going to talk about some of your work when we come back and take some phone calls as well. Nothing like it. Technology and the other side. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. By the way, Bill Murphy has what is called the Pearl Experiment. I'll have him talk about that. There's a photo we've posted on our Facebook page, and you can follow us there on Facebook as well. And like us there, and you'll get all kinds of information on a regular basis, too. You can do that by going to coasttocoastam.com. Bill, tell us about the Pearl Experiment.
The Pearl Experiment, you know, ironically, it was conducted right after I got the first Frank's box. No connection between the two. But the Pearl Experiment was to test the theory that perhaps what people perceive as to be events that are paranormal in origin could be as a result of a thought form manifestation, which people are somehow altering their own environment, which sometimes results in evidence that can be recorded that would suggest that perhaps a place is haunted or there's some sort of entities around. I was following the Philip experiment from the 1970s. That was my original inspiration, and I wanted to see if we could modernize that by recording electronic voice phenomena attributed to Pearl, because there were some unique sounds that we wrote into Pearl's history and a unique appearance that we wrote into Pearl's history. And although we did not, to my knowledge, record any EVPs that would suggest anything like Pearl with the, because she would spin these pearls that she would wear and make a clacking sound. So we were listening for those unique sounds. However, a visitor to the hotel where we conducted this experiment at, that was not present at the original event, was taking photographs in the lobby and photographed a figure, a female figure in the mirror. And that figure resembles the description of Pearl, but the person herself doesn't appear anywhere in the lobby. So we've tried to replicate that photo, and no matter where you try to position a model and a photographer, you always end up having the model in the camera's frame if you want her to be reflected in the mirror. And there were some very unique aspects to Pearl that we had described in the written accounts of Pearl, all fictitious, and the reflection has those characteristics. So that sort of put me on this path of trying to understand thought form manifestations. And now there's been a lot of other things that have occurred since then, and all that's being added to the Pearl Experiment DVD.
Okay, let's go to some of the phones. We've got AC, east of the Rockies, Jackson, Tennessee. Welcome to the program, AC. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Sure.
I had a similar experience to what your guest there is talking about the voices, except I believe in the ones I had. So I'm a retired truck driver, and I was going through West Texas from El Paso down to Laredo, down back roads, and I had my CB radio on. Now, I had a CB radio that had a bunch of side bands, you know, some extra channels and frequencies on it. And I was on one of those side bands. And all of a sudden, there was a lot of static and then some beeping, almost like Morse code. And then there was a voice came over the radio in a deep growling sound in a language I have never heard before. And then all of a sudden, the static came back and a loud pop, and everything on the radio went back to normal. And I've always thought, you know, I was outside of Sanderson, Texas, you know, Marfa, Texas, and all that is in the area. But I've always just attributed it to some kind of possible alien. I don't know what you would call it, you know, the first, second, or whatever, third kind, but, you know, it being sounds and voices, but that's just, you know, what I've always attributed to because of the area I was in.
That's a great story. And, you know, area is got a lot to do with it, I think, too. Bill, in your particular case, what have you learned about what you think the other side might be?
It's hard to describe what would be non-physical in human terms and try to understand it. I mean, certainly you can grasp the notion of an energetic environment that would be invisible to our eyes. Certainly, you know, people can have an unusual appearance under various light, forms of light that our eyes are normally not sensitive to. And if I was going to describe what that would be like, George, to answer your question, I would probably have to describe what is the residual after a person would pass, if this is even a possibility. We could only be expressed in terms of frequencies, electronic frequencies. And it's easy to compare that to radio, but I don't think it would be under any of the frequencies associated with any of the known radio bands.
No, not at all. That's a good point. Would you call the Ouija board a crude way of communicating with the other side?
Well, if we look at the origin of the Ouija board, it's hard for me to say that because it was really a safe game that a male and a female could play. That in the days when a date would take place in a parlor and you would have a chaperone there, you know, you allow the male and the female to have their knees touching and put the board on top and you'd see where their hands are. So there'd be nothing unknown going on, and the chaperone wouldn't even have to be looking directly. And in fact, they used to use chaperone mirrors in the South, so like it's like a fisheye mirror. And they would play Ouija in these party games. So it really wasn't until, again, the 1970s when movies started to depict Ouija boards in a sense of being able to contact negative entities that it took that sort of demonic bent. I still think a Ouija board is as innocent as can be. It's cardboard and plastic or wood in the case of the original ones.
Let's go to Blair, Sedona, Arizona. Hey, Blair, always a pleasure. Go ahead.
Thanks, George. Mr. Murphy, Whitley Strieber wrote a book called The Key, and he talked about other side communication. And recently I saw Dr. Stephen Greer, who talked about astral projection through electronics. Do you think this box is an initial attempt at that type of technology, and the realm could be the astral realm that you're communicating with?
Blair, that's interesting question. I would think perhaps an experience that could be described as that by a person, perhaps when they're engaged in a box session, may seem that way. It certainly can be hypnotic in some regards. When you're engaged in a very busy, active box session, I think most people do forget about where they're sitting and where they are, and they're focused on the sound, which is fleeting. I don't know if it actually would trigger have an astral projection moment or not. I've never experienced that, and I have many, many hours of box sessions under my belt. So I had not done it myself, but great question, Blair.
There's a documentary out there called The Stanley Effect, Bill, which highlights a lot of Frank's work. Can people watch that somewhere?
I just posted a video from The Stanley Effect on YouTube. It's just a real short piece because, you know, people, they'll glance at YouTube for under 2 minutes and then they navigate to another one. So I did just post that, and it's Frank Sumption at the Stanley Hotel is what I labeled it. The DVD is also available, though, on my ghosttown.tv site. There is a bonus disc in there that has an extensive interview with Frank going into his home. That is being included. If I could mention something really quickly, something
sure.
That one of Frank's colleagues, ended up being a good friend of all of us in the community, Tim Woolworth. He created a GoFundMe website donor page, and if you go to GoFundMe and you just enter Frank Sumption in there, it'll bring up a lot of things that people have contributed to remember the legacy of Frank in hopes that people would could help with the funeral costs that are being incurred by the sudden passing of Frank. And the Sumptions are, you know, this was unexpected to them. But in there, I have also put in there a DVD that has the complete interview with Frank in his home. So it's one of the rewards that Adona could obtain there.
Bill, how old was Frank? Do we know?
Yes, we do. He was a relatively young man. He was 63.
Oh, geez. Yeah.
That is young. If I could share something really personal for your listeners that they may find of interest, and this comes from Norma Sumption, Frank's widow. I spoke to her after the news hit, and like you, George, I wanted to see, was this true, or is this, you know, one of those...
Right. I mean, we had a difficult time verifying this, Bill.
I can imagine. But, you know, I did speak to her the next day, and Norma said that, in retrospect, for the past couple of weeks, she was sort of replaying the conversations and comments in her mind. And Norma says she believes now that Frank was actually trying to prepare her for what happened on the 16th. Now, she was at work. He called her, and he said that he wasn't feeling well and that it didn't seem like it was something that was going to go away on its own. And she rushed home, picked him up, brought him to the hospital where he had a heart attack. They rushed him into surgery, and he passed away. So this was, you know, 90 minutes from the call, he was gone. His two Yorkies, his little lovely little yapping dogs that I met that were always under his feet, following everywhere, would jump up into his arms every moment they could. He wouldn't even look. He would just catch them, both of them with one arm. They're still standing at the door waiting for Frank to walk in. As Norma said, she's catching herself doing the same thing. So it was all very fast, but Frank seemed to somehow know. And speaking of those predictions, it was about a month ago. He said in a month, things will change. He spoke of it in a global sense, but perhaps he was really referring to himself. He said things would end.
Do you think that the wife may use Frank's box to communicate with him?
I don't think so. What a warm, wonderful woman she is, and Frank was as well. They were both very welcoming me into their home, trusting me as a person that was a producer putting together a documentary about Colorado, and Frank was part of that landscape and his work. And they allowed me in, and I think she saw it as one of Frank's interests, but he was a lot more than just a builder of Frank's box. He built recumbent bikes. He was always tinkering in workshops. He had his grandkids running around. He's got two sons, Bill Mefford and Chad Sumption, and an extended family. And he was just a normal guy that was really busy, but he built his Frank's box, and that's where he's gotten his notoriety. I don't believe his wife really... had the time necessarily or the desire to be fiddling with them like Frank did. I wouldn't say it consumed Frank because he did so much besides that, but certainly Frank was the one that was the master of his own workshop.
Well, he sure was. Yeah, let's go to Ann in Toronto now, east of the Rockies. Ann, thanks. You're on with Bill Murphy on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I used to do such things as a kid, play with the radio and up and down with the AM, FM, but I also had more fun with the telephone. Before we actually had to use the area code before we dialed our number, I used to click in with people on my phone before I even, you know, I'd pick up the phone, and I could hear them talking, and then I used to say stuff like, "You better get off the phone because you're my worst nightmare," or "I'm your worst nightmare," and stuff like that, just to get them off the phone. But I used to scare people pretty good. So what do you think about that?
Oh, I certainly remember those days fondly. The days before we had dial area codes, you'd pick up the phone, it'd be a party line. And, you know, they were called party lines because you never knew who was going to be on the line. And as so many more devices started to gobble up available phone numbers, they started to add... you know, more and more area codes, and then it became a requirement. But I remember those days, and thank you for bringing it up. It was a great part of my childhood.
Sure was. Exciting stuff. Alex in Los Angeles, it's your turn. Go ahead, Alex.
I had a CB radio one time, and I kept picking up strange voices on CB, and I couldn't make it out, but I knew they weren't from the regular CBs. They were all offbeat.
What do you think of that, Bill?
Well, then you and Frank both have something in common, sir. You know, Frank was a ham radio operator, and I think that's what really caught his interest very much in trying to tune places that were very distant and some places that you could not determine what its origin was. The sounds were unusual. Sometimes it wasn't a language being spoken, but it was signals coming through. And Frank spoke about those days of being a ham radio operator. I myself, as a kid, used to use a shortwave radio that was actually a World War II Army issue radio that my father had that was in one of the upstairs bedrooms. And I used to do kind of that same thing, but I couldn't broadcast. I could only listen in between the stations and try to see how far of a signal could I actually get. It's intriguing to do that, and you know, I also miss those days as well of using radios as opposed to always on the internet.
Do you think those souls from the other side know that there's a apparatus available for the communication, or are they simply babbling all the time?
You know, George, there seems to be such a rich history of electronics being the tool of communication in ways unexpected. I mean, even just a regular telephone, a regular wired phone, after World War II, I'm sure you certainly are aware of these accounts, the number of family members that would get phone calls from people that were lost during World War II, they would call their family, they would say goodbye. They would not be able to return home, only for those people to be visited by two uniformed officers days later and deliver that telegram and deliver that personal note, and they would find out that their family member who was lost during the war died prior to the phone call coming through. So it's the mystery is wide and deep, and it goes as far back as the invention of electronics itself.
Bill, when you've been doing this, and you've been doing this how long?
I started in 1992.
92. Was there an episode that got you hooked into this?
My parents had a great interest in world culture, and sometimes that included various religions and the occult and Haitian art. Even though they were devout Catholics, they were art buyers in New Orleans, and they traveled the world, and so they were interested in anthropology and ancient civilizations, and I didn't necessarily pick up that exact interest, and I certainly did not have the same interest in the occult, but I did have an interest in the paranormal. Growing up in a city like New Orleans, I liked the kid that we had more cemeteries to play in than we did actual playgrounds. And so, you know, whispering to headstones is something that was just part of the landscape of me growing up. And in 92, I went back to visit my parents in New Orleans. I'd already moved to Los Angeles. And I went back, and then I kind of saw New Orleans through a visitor's eyes, and some of the things that was occurring in my parents' house that the, what I like to say, the old folks were talking about, you know, my parents and uncles and grandparents, the things that they were seeing and reporting on that I never saw. Well, when I went back to their house, I started to kind of get a glimpse of what they were referring to. And that's when I said, okay, maybe there's a way I can do this, not objectively, but, you know, through subjective media recording.
Are you absolutely convinced the other side exists?
I lean more towards thought forms. I whatever is happening, George, I believe requires to be powered by the living. I don't know if it would happen on its own. Just like when you set up instrumentation to look at the duality of matter on a quantum scale, it takes that human intervention and that monitoring for the changes in properties to occur. I think the paranormal is the same way. It takes people power.
That's a great theory. Bill, thanks so much for being on the program as we talk about the memory of the late Frank Sumption, the creator of Frank's Box, to communicate with the other side. Much more to go right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back.